Welcome to the 67th A.W. Mellon Lectures in the Fine Arts. In this six-part lecture series, entitled Positive Barbarism, Brutal Aesthetics in the Post-War Period, art historian Hal Foster explores the pervasive turn from the mid-1940s to the early 1960s to the bru and the brutalist, the animal and the creaturely, as these are manifest in the early work of Jean Dubuffet, Georges Bataille, Asger Jorn, Eduardo Paolozzi, and Klaus Oldenburg. In this third lecture, entitled Georges Bataille and His Caves, delivered at the National Gallery of Art on April 22, 2018, Foster asks what Bataille saw in the enigma of the cave paintings of Lascaux.
Sorry to drag everyone in on such a beautiful day, especially to drag you in to the caves. But as in Plato, maybe there'll be enlightenment, who knows? Maybe in Plato there's not enlightenment. Anyway. Last time we followed Jean Dubuffet as he pursued an entree into art by way of a departure from it, through the positing of an art brute, somehow unscathed by official culture. Today I want to trace a related search for a new ground of post-war practice, one no less paradoxical, taken up by the French philosopher Georges Bataille. In his case, the ground is projected not as an outside to artistic culture, as an art brute, but at its very origin, in the caves of prehistoric man. Here's a photograph of Bataille at Lascaux, the famous site in the Dordogne, discovered in 1940. It is 1952, and he is 58 years old. Pen in hand and notebook in lap, Bataille sits on a craggy rock in a long overcoat and looks up at the paintings in the entrance to the cave known as the Hall of Bulls. Obviously staged, the photo is an image about the writing of images, one that might recall artistic representations of St. John transcribing his visions on Patmos. Yet Bataille gazes into the prehistoric past, not the apocalyptic future, into the beginnings of man, not the end of days. Or does he? In his mind, the two converge. A little later, Bataille proposed a film about the cave paintings, jotting down the first of his notes on two postcards from Lascaux. His scenario, which was never produced, opens with a range of ritual practices concerning the dead, from primitive funereal festivals to Italian mortuary chapels. So many instances of burial that philosophers, at least since Vico, have taken to distinguish our species from other primates. Quickly, however, Bataille shifts from these foundational activities of human culture to lurid scenes of animals killing animals, of men killing animals, and finally of men killing men, at which point he underscores another practice specific to the human. Man is the only animal that kills its kind obstinately and furiously. A war scene, which we can only associate with the recent world conflagration, is followed by a conjuring of an absolute night, which we can only understand as the total darkness of nuclear annihilation, a global threat to all mankind since the American obliteration of Hiroshima and Nagasaki several years before. Everything quiets, Bataille writes. And then, in a jump cut across vast stretches of time, he continues, the sun arises on an earth on which life has yet to appear. In the final section of the scenario, after millions of years have passed, life slowly returns to this blighted world in the form first of microbes, then of vegetation, and finally of bugs, fish, birds, and fauna. Yet this is only the old life come again. driven as it is by a passion for destruction. A final note reads, "An immense variety of small animals and insects tear each other to pieces." This is how he thinks. Again and again in the 1950s, Bataille connected the eventual extinction of human life with the emergence of Homo sapiens, which he took to be announced, however ambiguously, in the paintings of Lascaux and other caves of the Upper Paleolithic period. In his time, the Lascaux images were dated to almost 30,000 BCE. Now it is somewhere between 15 and 20,000 BCE. This link between prehistory and post-history is unexpected. And apparently it surprised Bataille too. In a lecture in 1955, again with the discovery of Lascaux and the threat of annihilation in mind, he has only this to say: "I am simply struck by the fact that light is being shed on our birth at the very moment when the notion of our death appears to us." His was a generation of French intellectuals that before World War II had pondered the Hegelian proposition that the end of history had come, schooled in the subject by Alexandre Kojève, the great. Difference was that after the Holocaust and the hydrogen bombs, this end was no longer hypothetical. It was the specter of the actual end of man that prompted Bataille, as it did others at this time, such as the architectural historian Siegfried Gideon, to speculate on the possible origins of the human. For us, Bataille wrote also in 1955, a new but indefinite time is being born, in a manner similar to the first dawn. What is the time that Bataille evokes here? What is involved in his montage of prehistory and post-history, of the caves where humans first emerged and the ruins through which they now wandered? In what ways was the remote ascent from animality called up by the recent descent into barbarism? Well known as a dissident surrealist in the Parisian avant-gardes of the 1920s, Bataille is less familiar as a controversial thinker in the 1930s and 40s, who, skeptical of both the unstable socialism of the Popular Front and the rigid Stalinism of the Communist Party, explored the psychology of fascism with an ambivalence that remains troublesome to this day. However, after the turpitude of the occupation, the devastation of the World War, and the horror of the Shoah, the 1950s presented a different conjuncture, and Bataille redirected his thought, in large part through a turn to questions of prehistory. To a degree, this shift was provoked by the publication in 1952 of 400 Centuries of Cave Art by the Abbé Henri Breuil, the preeminent prehistorian of the previous generation, who gathered his extensive research on the Franco-Cantabrian caves in this volume. Breuil was the first expert to be called to Lascaux after its discovery. You see him here. Reviewed by Bataille a year later, 400 Centuries guided his own thinking on prehistoric art, even though he disagreed with many of its conclusions. Several essays on the subject preceded his own book, Prehistoric Painting, Lascaux, or The Birth of Art, which appeared in spring 1955. And a few more texts followed it, including his final book, The Sketchy Tears of Eros, written in 1959, when Bataille was already quite sick, and published in 1961, a year before his death. Now, just to situate you a little here, are the caves as he presented them in his own book. And you see Lascaux there, the upper right. Now, if you drop down directly, almost all the way down, you'll see Les Trois Frères, which is the other cave that I will take up, as indeed Bataille did. Bataille renders the distant past of the caves very present in the pages of his book, Lascaux. There's great immediacy, not only in its lively prose, which he made almost melodramatic for the popular readership that his publisher, Albert Sciarra, hoped to attract, but also in its deluxe photographs, which were the first color images of Lascaux to be published. Together, the prose and the photos take us on a virtual tour of the caves as though we were alongside Bataille. I insist upon the surprise we experience at Lascaux, he writes early in the book, and later he comments, line and color have been left miraculously untouched by passing ages. Our response to this art is so direct that we lose all idea of time. Bataille summons a powerful aura here. Aura in the sense, given the term by Walter Benjamin, a sudden coincidence of the very remote and the very near. Not just a publishing ploy, this effect of immediacy was essential to the thesis of Lascaux. For Bataille insists not only on the presentness of the animals depicted on the walls and the rituals performed in relation to them, but also on our own participation in the miracle of humanity begun there. If Lascaux represents the birth of art and man alike, it is an origin that, in his view, must be recovered, even reenacted in the present. Lascaux asks us no longer to deny what we are, Bataille argues. Through its contemplation, we can finally gauge what that identity is. Note the odd past-future temporality here. It is a preposterous tense that recurs in his writing on parietal art. Parietal art here just means cave walls. The registers of knowing and unknowing are also ambiguous. Yet one thing is clear. However resisted or repressed, the essential mystery of our humanity lies encrypted in the caves. Here then is my thesis for today. Prehistoric art suggested to Bataille an origin story that both repositions the role of the ritualistic in art and recovers the importance of the sacred in society. An origin story that, if retold and reclaimed, might help post-war man cope with his passion for destruction, that is, to live on par with death. Okay, this first section is titled Coherent Disorder. In the introduction to Lascaux, Bataille focuses on practices that distinguish Homo sapiens from his Neanderthal predecessors, and art is foremost among them. This is already announced in its subtitle, The Birth of Art. And throughout the book, the cave images are presented as aesthetic creations, with the animals often photographed as single figures, which they rarely are in situ. The miracle occurred at Lascaux, Bataille writes early on, our first sign of art and also of man. Consider the priority here. It is as though man were the outcome of art, not the other way around. Previously, Breuil had claimed aesthetic activity at Lascaux and other caves, as had his colleague Fernand Wendels. Wendels dubbed the Hall of Bulls the Sistine Chapel of prehistory. And other spaces have churchly designations too, like the nave and the apse. But it is Bataille who insists on art as the distinctive practice of Homo sapiens. If his Neanderthal predecessor also possessed a basic set of tools, a primitive form of language, a consciousness of death, and even a version of burial, the fact remains, Bataille argues, that we know no work of art before Aragnacian man of the Upper Paleolithic period. Yet, as we will see, if the birth of the human is punctual for Bataille, the passage of animal to man, this is a favorite phrase, is a threshold that can be traversed in both directions again and again. I should say right away that I'm concerned here with what Bataille believed, not what prehistorians think today. Maybe you will have seen recent reports that this idea that the Neanderthal did not have a version of art is now much disputed. In the first instance, Bataille frames prehistory as a protest against utilitarian activity, or the art of prehistory as a protest against utilitarian activity. So this epochal shift is also one from a world of work alone to a world of play as well. In some respects, Bataille rethinks Homo sapiens in terms of the Homo ludens of Johann Huizinga, whose celebrated text of that title was published in 1938. Only a few years before Lascaux, in the first volume of The Accursed Share of 1949, Bataille had articulated his theory of a general economy, according to which the central problem for any society is not how to deal with scarcity, but how to discharge surplus. This is the accursed share that must be spent in games, festivals, potlatches, and indeed art. And his rejection of the primacy of the utilitarian continues in Lascaux. Bataille makes this case not only in general terms. Only man who plays counters the Neanderthal man who works, but also in specific relation to parietal art. Only play and not some practical purpose could have prompted the cave paintings. By practical purpose, Bataille means any imagined control over the depicted animals by means of representation. The calculative simplicity of magic explains nothing about the images for him. The cave paintings are not utilitarian in this way. In fact, many arise from gratuitous doodlings and unintelligible signs. That is, many are not even mimetic in the first instance. This reading leads Bataille to see the pictures as discovered as much as invented, as prompted by natural contours, cracks, and colorations in a given wall, or even by bare scratchings. It is plain that the art of imitating the outer aspect of animals by means of painting or engraving could not have been put to use before it came into being, and in order to be, it had first to be found in the course of accident, chance, or play. This emphasis on the ludic and the aleatory bespeaks a modernist aesthetic. One thinks of the surrealist embrace of chance and accident in particular. Not incidentally, a parallel position was advanced in an art historical inquiry of the time. In 1956, only a year after the publication of Lascaux, Ernst Gombrich delivered his Mellon Lectures on the Psychology of Perception, in which he argued famously that making comes before matching. That is, that the making of a representation with its conventions of depiction, which Gombrich calls schemata, precedes the matching of the representation to the world with its criteria of verisimilitude. However, in Lascaux, Bataille suggests, again in a manner consistent with his old surrealist milieu, that finding precedes both making and matching. In a sense, Lascaux is the ultimate trouvaille, the ultimate found object. Found object, of course, is a key term in surrealist aesthetics. After the introduction, Bataille tours the principal sections of Lascaux one by one. And here you see them, the Hall of the Bulls, which leads to the Axial Gallery. Take a right towards the nave and the apse. And I want you to see where the shaft is. I will call it the well. It's a famously crucial area of Lascaux. So he tours the principal sections. He is concerned first with the composition of the pictures, or rather the lack thereof, especially in the Hall of Bulls and the Axial Gallery. The hall, an expansive cavern, is dominated by a cavalcade of horses, punctuated by a few massive bulls and smallish deer, while the gallery, a tight cul-de-sac, presents a range of animals, mostly horses and bulls again, but also cows, ibexes, asses, bison, and a bear, some of which appear in the nave and the apse as well, which are accessed through a passage to the right of the hall of the bulls. To different degrees, figures overlap or are superimposed in all these spaces, which suggests to Bataille, who follows Breuil here, that the pictures were produced over an extended period. Often, too, almost every available patch of wall is used. Along with a confusion of figures, then, there is a disorientation of the viewer, especially in the axial gallery. Action splits, scurries in every direction, and images appear on the ceiling in ways that defeat any possibility of unity. These characteristics, overlapping, superimposition, all-overness, multi-directionality, they all defy the basic principles that we take to underlie pictorial composition, such as a clear opposition of figure and ground, a set relation of center to edge, and a consistent point of view. Again, no one perspective or sequence of perspectives is assumed. The effect is contradictory. Bataille coins the oxymoron coherent disorder to describe it. And it leads him to propose a performative basis for the pictures, which were made, he argues in a key passage, in a rite of evocation that was sacrificial in impulse. The actual doing embodied the entire intention, Bataille asserts, and the repeated drawing of the animals, they would not erase or cover the older images. You get a sense here through this line drawing how this performative, reiterative activity is done. They would not erase or cover the older images, how this was central to the ritual. Hence the great confusion of figures. This doing occurred in a shamanistic trance, Bataille speculates, which also rendered the artists indifferent to the state of the cave wall after the drawing. Thus, if we assume that the pictures are compositions intended for viewers like us, we get them entirely wrong. The essential thing was not the coherence of the images, but the apparition of the animals, to make them present in rites performed in deep darkness, pierced only by torchlight. In a sense, then, the picturing is magical, but again, not in the utilitarian way advanced by Breuil, who saw them only as a ritual preparation for big expeditions. For Bataille, the apparition is not a controlling, but a conjuring. And the images are not referential, but visionary. The moment the animal is seen, he writes, is a passionate moment. And the animals are relatively well-formed because they have to be, in a sense, rendered present in the ritual. This, at least, is his initial explanation. Note that there is no division between ritual and art for Bataille, as there was for other philosophers, Benjamin prominent among them. In fact, it is crucial to Bataille that art recapture this ritualistic basis. A moment ago, I said that parietal art challenged basic principles of pictorial composition, but this is mostly a modernist projection of my own, for these principles were not in place to be challenged. Certainly the images in Lascaux and other caves follow certain conventions. For example, after Breuil, Bataille notes the twisted perspective of some of the depicted animals. That is, sometimes bodies are presented in profile while heads or horns are turned three quarters or full face, as with the bison here. Yet for the most part, Bataille highlights the elaboration of implicit configurations found in the walls because it is not clear what mimetic schemata in the Gombrichian sense, conventions of representation, It's not clear if they existed or if they did exist, what they were, if they existed at all as yet. Let me elaborate on this point briefly. In an important text from 1969, Meyer Shapiro argued that the wall of cave art was not regarded as a field. That is, even if it was scraped down, its surfaces were not smoothened, its extent not bounded, and its figures not ordered. Such a prepared support was an invention of a later stage of humanity, one that accompanied the development of polished tools in the Neolithic and Bronze Ages and the creation of pottery, and an architecture with regular courses of jointed masonry. It is this prepared field that was a precondition for such conventions as the transparency of the picture plane and the illusion of pictorial depth, neither of which pertain in cave painting. Not only is the image not seen as fully distinct from its support, the wall, but the image is not understood as entirely separate from its referent, the animal. In effect, the wall is treated less as a ground for representation than as a membrane for conjuration. Animals are not represented from the outside world on the wall so much as they are made present from a spirit realm through the wall. Again, the act of painting is less mimetic than evocative, and the primordial convention that art exists first and last to be beheld is here not primordial at all. Last time we saw how the art of the child and the insane also question this assumption for de Buffet. It is this apparent status as a near tabula rasa, which Bataille does not fully articulate, that allows him to claim Lascaux as the very birthplace of art, as a miracle that precedes and so trumps all other fresh sprung arts, such as those of ancient Egypt and Greece, so privileged by Gombrich and countless others. At Lascaux, nothing had to be broken, nothing needed undoing, Bataille writes. Lascaux was the first doing, the first step, the beginning. But what kind of beginning of art is so ambiguous about basic matters of form and composition? And what kind of beginning of man is so equivocal about fundamental distinctions between the human and the animal? Okay, the next section is titled Three Enigmas. And it's so weird that I need a drink that's stronger than water. In Lascaux, Bataille confronts three enigmas that he places at the heart of prehistoric art. First enigma. Why are the animals represented with such grace while the humans are rendered so crudely? Why exalt beasts and debase man in this way? As Alois Riegel might say, this dichotomy is a matter of artistic will, not technical skill. Apparently, man from the earliest times could have depicted his brethren with the same precision he used with animal images. Bataille writes, he did not want to do this. Bataille describes the animals as conform, or well-formed, and the humans as en form, or formless. It is as though for prehistoric man, the animals were human and the humans were animalistic. This counterintuitive hierarchy is registered in the number of figures too. Humans are rare in Aurignacian art. Only about 75 images and objects from the upper Paleolithic period are extant. Second enigma. What is signified by the figures that combine anthropomorphic and zoomorphic features, which are even rarer than the crudely human ones? If the first dichotomy in representation indicates an originary difference between man and animal, do these therianthropic creatures point to a persistent affinity between them? Or does the combination of features bespeak another relationship altogether, a mix of identification with the animal and obeisance to it. Third enigma, what exactly is at stake in the famous scene located in an obscure shaft in Lascaux known as the Well, involving a disemboweled bison and a supine man, who significantly is ictophilic, that is, his penis is erect? What possible mystery is invoked there? Let me take these riddles one by one. Bataille mentioned the first enigma, the shocking duality at the beginning of figurative representation, well before the discovery of Lascaux. It appeared initially in his 1930 review of a book titled L'Art Primitif by Georges-Henri Luquet, the pioneer in the study of the art of children, whom we encountered last time with Dubuffet. And already there, Bataille claimed this dichotomy as a key to the psychology of prehistoric man. However, a long pause in this line of thought ensued. Bataille took up related questions in the 1930s and 40s, but not this exact one. He returned to it only in 1952, when Breuil published his 400 Centuries of Cave Art. This book prompted Bataille to three texts in quick succession, an unpublished lecture in 1952 and two articles in 1953, followed by another talk in 1955, just prior to the appearance of Lascaux. Yet even after the publication of this book, this enigma reappears in his writings. It is a contradiction that Bataille does not resolve, but only repeats. So it is with the variations in a mythic narrative, according to Claude Lévi-Strauss. And certainly this enigma has mythic force for Bataille. Perhaps he wanted not to resolve the enigma so much as to reactivate it, precisely as a myth. In any case, it is essential to him, and he believes essential to us, to puzzle over its terms. What it is to be human may be secreted there. Both before and after Lascaux, Bataille also considered prehistoric figures of women, most of which are tiny sculptures in stone or ivory, such as the celebrated Venuses of Willendorf and the Spug, just over 4 inches and just under 6 inches tall, respectively. They are named after the towns in Austria and France near which they were discovered. Although not nearly as well formed as the animal pictures, these female figures are not quite as formless as the male ones. They constitute a third world, Bataille comments vaguely. And yet he argues the women have two points in common with the men. Their human aspect is also suppressed, and emphasis falls on their sexual organs. He accepts the standard claim that the figures represent an ideal of female fertility, but notes that here, idealization tends in the direction of what to us is deformity. Not only are they steatopagus Aphrodites, that's his phrase, that is, breasts and hips are exaggerated, but some are also headless. And if they possess a face at all, it is a sheer surface without eyes, mouth, or ears. In our modern idea of feminine beauty, breasts, hips, and buttocks are sublimated. After Freud, Bataille calls them the secondary sexual characteristics. Yet the prehistoric Venuses have nothing in common or nothing to do with the sublimation. On the contrary, the exaltation of these features inextricably links the beauty of the body with its sexual activity. It is as though this beauty existed before or outside sublimation, but not, obviously enough, before or outside sexual difference, which is remarked by the opposition between the ictophilic man and the steatopagus women. Bataille does little with this opposition, however, focused as he is on the riddle posed by both male and female figures. Why do the humans appear negated in comparison with the animals? The men rendered featureless and the women faceless. And this during the very epoch when human beings had attained, for the first time, an aspect similar to ours, as opposed to that of apes. Why this figural deformity at the very time when human form was finally achieved? Within this riddle of dichotomous images of humans and animals lies another enigma, our second one, for the human figures are also divided internally. While most are reduced and schematic, some are hybrid and complex. Again, in the first type of representation, both male and female figures are mostly stripped of human features, often including the face, which Bataille reads as a sign of an extreme devaluation of the human. In the second type, however, the figures are granted a few human attributes. More importantly, they are also clad in the glory of the beast, which Bataille takes to be an enormous elevation of the human. If the stick man in the Lascaux well exemplifies the first reduced type, the strange creature known as the sorcerer in Les Trois Frères, a cave well south of Lascaux, represents the second hybrid type. Both incised and painted, this figure, 2.5 feet tall, is neither vertical nor horizontal. Broyle understands him to dance or to prance, a posture that places the sorcerer ambiguously between the human and the animal in orientation. And his features are also mixed. While his beard, legs, feet, hands, and sexual organs are relatively human, his antlers and ears derive from a stag, his tail from a horse. His owlish face is especially odd, and his outward gaze is very rare. Typically, Broyle reads the sorcerer in functionalist terms, as a spirit controlling the multiplication of game and hunting expeditions. Yet his status is not clear. In fact, nothing is certain about this figure, who embodies a confusion that is also sexual. His penis appears to curve up and outward from his anus. Is there an unknown logic, a pensée préhistorique, encoded in this complex image? In any case, such hybrid figures are male, which points to a gendered division of roles in prehistoric art, at least according to Bataille. Women represent the physical realm of sex and reproduction, while men preside over the sacred realm of eroticism and death. Two other figures at Les Trois Frères are also animal-human hybrids, mostly bison from the waist up and partly man from the waist down. Both are ichthyophilic, phallic as well. One of the creatures, just a foot high, appears more bison than man. And like the sorcerer, he is neither vertical nor horizontal. The other creature, only 8 inches high, is more vertical, which is to say more human in posture. After Broyle, Bataille understands him to play a musical bow. Sometimes he also slips into anecdotal accounts. And in doing so, he sees this figure to lead the animals that appear before him in an animal symphony. Though the actual welter of bison, horses, and reindeer here is far less composed than the term symphony suggests. Maybe you can pick him out in the center left there. Clearly, this is less a composition of pictorial figures than a repetition of ritual acts. Bataille credits this bison man with a promise of triumphal domination, but stipulates that, as with the sorcerer, this domination comes only on the condition that his humanity be masked. This last paradox soon emerges as a key to the second enigma that all three figures at Les Trois Frères pose for Bataille. Again, he insists that they are removed from any utilitarian purpose. The sorcerer in particular signals a no to the man who works. More, Bataille detects here an apology for the disruption that human labor brought to the animal world, as if amends were required for the real power that calculating deliberation had won for emergent man. Obviously, Bataille projects this sense of contrition. He needs it to explain why prehistoric man would hide his features behind an animal mask. Why, at the very moment that he achieved his human aspect, he would conceal it as though he were ashamed of his face. This is the paradox that the hybrid appearance of the shamanistic figures at Les Trois Frères registers for Bataille. The second enigma confuses Bataille more than the first, or rather, he shares in the confusion that he sees encoded in the therianthropic figures, a confusion that he ascribes to the ambiguous status of the animal for prehistoric man. In the first instance, according to Bataille, the animal represents raw life, that other world of wildness, of darkness, which man sheds in order to become human at all, to become the man not only of work and taboo, but also of art and play. It is this animality to which man reverts at times of sacrifice, festival, and the rite of evocation that is the painting of the caves. In other words, man establishes this animality only and precisely at the moment of his emergence from it. All at once, the animal is defined as other to the stifling regularity of the human order. And this, in turn, sets up animality as the condition to which man regresses when he overflows into savagery and thrills to transgression. The passage of animal to man is thus not simple, nor is it final, for it can be reversed. Moreover, in its new difference from the human, the animal also comes to represent other figures of alterity, of otherness to man. Not only the dead, but also the divine, which are not very distinct at this point. It is for this reason that Bataille refers to the sorcerer also as a god. In this way, then, the animal is positioned both below man and above man, at once subhuman and superhuman, subordinate and sovereign. No wonder the sorcerer and his confrères appear confused. They exist not only between man and beast, but also between man and God. This ambiguity may be irreducible. Certainly for Bataille, it expresses an ambivalence towards certain animals that is fundamental to prehistoric people. They loved them and they wanted them, he writes. They loved them and they killed them. This brings us to the third enigma, which is encrypted in a small group of pictures in the Lascaux well, very famous set of pictures. For Bataille, as for many others, these are the most significant, the most strange, the most sacred of all the images in the Franco-Cantabrian caves. He calls them both the measure of this world and the holy of holies. To the right stands a bison just under 4 feet long. Its intestines balloon out of its large body as if bewildered. It twists its small head to take in this wound. In the center under the bison is an elongated stick figure, a supine man with a tiny head of a bird. Arms outstretched, he appears to be dead, but his penis is erect. This is no contradiction for Bataille, for whom eroticism and death are bound up with each other and with the sacred. Beneath the bird man is a straight line like a post topped by a schematic profile of another bird, and there are two other lines that resemble barbed arrows or spears. A short, broken one at the feet of the man, and a long, solid one that cuts across the hindquarters of the bison. Finally, to the left is a partially eroded rhinoceros, which seems to trot away, tail raised from the scene. In fact, it is not clear that the figures form a group, let alone a scene. For Bataille, the rhinoceros is irrelevant. And though they do not exhibit the coherent disorder of other animal images, they hardly comprise a neat composition. For Broil, however, the well scene is the only true composition in all Lascaux. He even reads it as a pictorial record of an actual event, a fatal accident during a hunting trip. The bison, wounded by the man or the rhinoceros or both, has killed the hunter whose broken spear lies beside him. Once again, Bataille demurs, at least in part, for there is a referent for him here too. Only a deeply religious intention could have motivated this figuration, he argues. This intuition leads Bataille to draw on the account presented by the German prehistorian Horst Kirchner, for whom the man is a shaman in the throes of an ecstatic trance. The bison is his sacrifice, and the bird on the post is its guide to the other world. Yet Bataille finds death as well as sacrifice in the scene, and the death of the man, writes, we can in fact only see a dead man in the fallen figure, is linked to the death of the animal. Stricken with guilt for his sacrificial murder, the man offers up his own life as a compensation to the first victim, the first sacrificial victim. It is this alleged encounter with death, touched by the sacred, that prompts Bataille to see the well scene as the inaugural moment of religion. This representation invites us who face it to draw a fundamental power from the contemplation of death, the power to live on par with death, which is proper to religions of all times. When Bataille returns to the scene a few years later in Eroticism of 1957, he sees it explicitly in terms of sacrifice and expiation. Yet when he recalls it one last time in the Tears of Eros of 1961, he deems it essential to go beyond this account. However, this beyond is little more than a final surrender to the essential mystery of the well. It's not really a question of solving this enigma, Bataille writes. Being the first enigma posed by humans, it asks us to descend to the bottom of the abyss opened in us by eroticism and death. Here to the primordial conjunction of death and the sacred, he adds the paradoxical accord between death and sexuality, as figured by the dead man with the erect penis. For Bataille, that accord is paradoxical only if we fail to see that all these states, death, eroticism, and the sacred, serve to restore the fundamental continuity that the advent of human life disturbs. Death means continuity of being, he argues in Eroticism, a continuity that life interrupts inasmuch as reproduction implies the existence of discontinuous beings. However momentarily, eroticism puts us back in touch with this continuity because it is a violation of the very being of its practitioners. And finally, the sacred is also the revelation of continuity, especially when we bear witness to its most charged occasion, the death of a discontinuous being during the solemn rite of a funeral. Bataille is fervently on the side of continuity too. As though in a last testament to his life project, he writes in the Tears of Eros, what we desire is to bring into a world founded on discontinuity all the continuity such a world can sustain. If you know his work across the decades, that desire for continuity, that desire to get beyond the discontinuous is absolutely fundamental. Now, as if this is not too speculative or speculative enough, let me indulge in a speculative aside. For a long time, traditionalists located the origins of Western art in ancient Egypt and Greece. For Gombrich and countless others, the miracle occurred when the Greek kouros, step free of the Egyptian block, as though of its own independent will, and with a slight twist of contrapposto, charge the human figure with a new animation, a human vitality. At this moment, sculpture became free in several senses of the word, and Western art was launched on its teleological pursuit of truth to lifeness. For Bataille, as we've seen, prehistoric Lascaux undercuts this humanist story of art. The caves are the site of the first doing, the first step, the beginning. Certainly the en-form and hybrid humans of Lascaux and Les Trois Frères present very different postures for the human. The first supine, either entranced or dead. The second suspended between the horizontal and the vertical, perhaps between beast and God, in any case, other than man as normally imaged. So too do the prehistoric enigmas of the stick man and the sorcerer appear to displace the classical riddle of that human posed to Oedipus by the Sphinx. The sorcerer appears almost to combine Oedipus and Sphinx in one impossible form. The answer to the riddle is still man, but the question of origin bears less on what distinguishes the human from the animal than on how they are bound together in the sacred. In this mythology, the wounded bison in the well also preempts the Greek minotaur. Certainly Bataille regarded the well scene as a sacrificial bullfight, perhaps the inaugural one, and his own quest in the caves can be understood as a personal tauromachy, personal bullfight. Whereas the minotaur, the product of a bull and a woman, Queen Pasiphae of Crete, was seen as a monster by the ancients, it was redeemed as a figure of the unconscious by surrealists like Man Ray. Here Bataille revises both readings of the minotaur in turn. The labyrinth where the monster is trapped becomes the cave where man emerges. And the probing of a private psyche becomes the recovery of a collective sacred. Okay, bear with me as I stretch this speculation even further. Implicitly, the well scene is also a primal scene. The Freudian term for the situation in which, as children, we witness, or believe we witness, sex between our parents. More, in which we believe we witness our own creation. And here I show you a drawing from the case history in which Freud developed the idea of the primal scene. Now, the primal scene is fundamentally enigmatic. Is it a memory, a fantasy, or a combination of the two? Actually, this may not be such a stretch after all, for the primal scene was an important model of surrealist picture making, especially for Max Ernst, which Bataille surely knew. Now, the uncertainty of the primal scene, again, is it real, imagined, or both, renders it spatially complex. As in a dream, we are positioned both as a viewer outside the scene and a participant within it. Nevertheless, Freud deemed the primal scene basic, so basic as to be phylogenetic, that is, a universal schema that each of us elaborates or can elaborate in his or her own way. In a sense, the well scene is even more universal than the primal scene. For here, according to Bataille, mankind witnesses its own coming into being. And as in Freud, so in Bataille, we are both audience of the scene and actor in it, which is at once seductive, traumatic, and enigmatic. Or more precisely, it is both seductive and traumatic because it is enigmatic. The impact of the scene, its value as well, are intensified by its ambiguity, Bataille writes. It introduces a dramatic element into an art where drama, though latent everywhere, seldom takes form. In fact, for Bataille, the well scene is intrinsically contradictory, given that it denies what it is usual to affirm, our human aspect, and shows what is ordinarily veiled, our sexual parts. And like a mythmaker, according to Levi-Strauss, Bataille offers up various versions of this enigma because he is not able, or perhaps not willing, to resolve the contradiction. In Lascaux, he suggests no less than four different relationships between the human and the animal. Separation of man from the animal understood as beast, effacement of man before the animal understood as sovereign, as divine, partial concealment of man in the guise of the animal as beast, and partial identification of man in the guise of the animal as sovereign. Okay, my final section is titled Continual Recreation. Already in his dissonant surrealist days, Bataille regarded sacrifice as a human action more significant than any other. Yet during this period, he attended mostly to its effects on the individual, its radical liberation of the person. However, by the mid-1930s, with the dominance of fascism and Nazism in Europe, Bataille stressed the importance of the sacred for the collective. In fact, he came to see sacred experience as essential to all social integration. Thus, he dedicated two projects, Acéphale and the Collège de Sociologie, to its reactivation. The first was an abortive publication, the second a failed philosophical society. And both were undertaken with his friends, Michel Leiris and Roger Caillois. Paradoxically, for all three thinkers, it is ambivalence, elementary phenomena of attraction and repulsion that animates the sacred and that binds the social. On the one hand, the taboos that define the sacred support social cohesion. On the other, the sacred depends on the periodic violation of these rules of life for its lifeblood. In this respect, Bataille and friends follow the great sociologist Marcel Mauss, who had already addressed the withering away of the sacred in modernity. Yet Mauss, good socialist, viewed this disenchantment as an historical advance, whereas for Bataille and company, it was a social catastrophe. For models of sacred experience, they looked not only to primitive cultures, but also to conservative institutions such as churches, armies, brotherhoods, secret societies. That's their list. In fact, the Collège de Sociologie aimed to be an elective community in its own right, a secret society, too. This is where the politics of Bataille become most problematic. The Collège emerged in a moment of crisis. The precarious popular front government of Léon Blum had fallen in July 1937, and quixotically, Bataille presented the Collège as a hermetic alternative to both social democracy and Stalinist communism. It's no wonder that it fell apart with the outbreak of the war. No wonder, too, that its equivocal attitude to fascism and Nazism was questioned both then and later. Yet even as Bataille understood that these ideologies had perverted the sacrificial dimension in society, he also saw that fascism and Nazism had tapped this neglected source to enormous effect. And the Collège implied that other political systems must do so too, and must do so otherwise. For Bataille, this task remained urgent after the war too, with the triumph of corporate capitalism on the one side and bureaucratic communism on the other, neither of which allowed for sacred experience. Why did Bataille consider the reactivation of the sacred so essential to post-war society? First, he placed sacred experience in direct opposition to the instrumental reason that had produced the World War, the Holocaust, and the bomb. Lascaux invites us to remember a time when human beings only wanted superiority over death, Bataille writes, not the utilitarian mastery that is peculiar to our times. To Bataille, the subjugation of other creatures was the epitome of this debased rationality. For us, animals are things which we precisely are not. What he leaves unspoken here is that human beings were also treated as beasts, worse than beasts, in the Holocaust. Implicitly then, to reawaken a sense of the sacred alterity of animals, which is so vivid in the caves, is to work against this horrific reduction of life to thing. And in this light, the dead stick man becomes the sign of contrition for any murder. Second, Bataille believed that eroticism must be recharged along with the sacred. Between prehistory and classical antiquity, sexual life went astray, he writes in The Tears of Eros. It lost its sacred character and became hardened because of war and slavery. This grand statement is his own version of the fall, and it is the direct opposite of the Christian one. Losing sexuality is the catastrophe, not discovering it. Bataille seeks a path to the reversal of this loss in the caves, where eroticism was first known and first celebrated. Moreover, it was only in the Paleolithic period, he asserts, that mankind seems to have escaped the horror of war and slavery. For Bataille, the fate of religion is reciprocal to that of sexuality. It lost its erotic character and was reduced to utilitarian morality, the complement of the utilitarian mastery that he had already decried. Why are the erotic and the sacred bound together in his view? Because both depend on the alternation of taboo and transgression. Neither the erotic nor the sacred can be or should be settled, for it is the pattern of reciprocity between taboo and transgression that animates both. On the one hand, taboo gives transgression its power. On the other, transgression does not deny taboo, but transcends it and completes it. For Bataille, the young surrealist, transgression was an act of subversion of the law. However, after the war, he positions it very differently. It becomes a means of the reinscription of the law, or at least of an accommodation with the law. The chief concern in the earliest days of the caves, Bataille argues now, was to bring work and play, prohibition, taboo and transgression, the profane season and the riot of holiday into a kind of delicate equilibrium. And so he implies, must it be the chief concern again in our time, in the latest days, which, threatened by nuclear holocaust, might well be the last days. At the end of his life, Bataille stressed the utter necessity of this continual recreation of taboo and transgression. Without such renewal, we will not be able to cope with our passion for destruction. Only through a recovery of sacred experience might we learn to live on par with death. And here, art had a key role to play. Again, in Lascaux and other texts, Bataille conceives art not only as a protest against utility, but also as an act of exuberance, as a way to discharge the excess energies that in any economy must be spent without profit. For Bataille, there are only two ways that this discharge can occur: gloriously, as in art, or catastrophically, as in war. Finally, for Bataille, to recover a sense of the sacred is to reclaim a relation to sovereignty, that is, to authority and power. Recall his view of the double position of the animal in the caves as both beast and god. Crucially, in neither position is the animal subject to taboo. The animal as beast is below the law, and the animal as god is above it. In acts of transgression and at times of ritual, such as the painting of the caves, man is in touch with both positions, with the instinctual world of raw sensation on the one hand, and with the heterogeneous world of divine sovereignty on the other. And from this double perspective, man can see through the law. That is, he can see that it is a matter, first and last, of authority, of power. For Bataille, any society must come to terms with this fact, that law is founded in violence, not in justice. He had understood this point in the 1930s. Indeed, he affirmed it then. For obvious reasons, he was more circumspect in the post-war period. But he still believed that the question of sovereignty and the dynamic of violence and law could not be ignored. Fascism and Nazism had produced an acute reactivation of the latent sovereign agency of what power really was about. Now this agency had to be transformed into wholly other terms. One could not return to the religious and royal edifice of the past, Bataille insisted. We can only go further. And one way to go further was to go back to the caves, to make them live again, as he put it, in ourselves. Not in the manner of the eternal present proposed by modernist humanists like Siegfried Gideon, but in the mode of an indefinite time, a preposterous time, in which the present might recapture the prehistorical in a continual recreation of the erotic, the sacred, and the sovereign. This finally is what Bataille seeks in the caves. Should the moral creation of man be renewed less often than his physical birth? Hence his emphasis at Lascaux and other sites on presence and participation, including our own, especially our own, however imagined it must be. Something touches us. We are stirred by it, as though in sympathy with the rhythms of a dance. In short, the indefinite time of the caves can be made our time too, if we take up its enigmas as our mysteries and use this mythical past to bring forth a rejuvenated world. Unlike de Buffet, Bataille understands that this ground is unstable from the start, and he makes a virtue of this uncertainty. The emergence of man and art is a perpetual birth. There is no one beginning, but always a beginning again, and that is a good thing. Rather than resolve the riddles of the well and the sorcerer, we must use the obscure contradiction that is encoded there to guarantee a generative disorder in our own thinking, that they constitute the most tragic among the enigmas of our species is precisely their value. They help us reflect on our conflicted nature and come to terms with the equivocal position of the human. Thank you.
This has been a National Gallery of Art production.